You're listening to CITR's UBC 100 Doc Series. We are broadcasting from the ancestral, unceded territory of the Hukkaminam-speaking Musqueam people at the University of British Columbia. In the last year, CITR has been digitizing our collection of reel-to-reel tapes and cassettes containing an archive of audio broadcast on UBC's campus and community radio station from 1949 to the late 90s. With help from the UBC University Archives and the UBC Library Digitization Center, 400 audio files are now available for the public to listen and download, with more on the way. To share this history, we have made a series of documentaries produced by students and community broadcasters. This project is funded by UBC's Centennial Initiative Fund, celebrating a century of success at UBC. Tune in every Thursday at 4 p.m. for the next 4 weeks from January 14th to February 4th for a new documentary. And visit our website, citr.ca/docs, for podcasts, interviews with the producers, and more information. If you live in Vancouver, you probably know what the Davie Village looks like. It's got rainbow crosswalks at Davie and Butte, and a big colorful mural on the wall of Community. The bus shelters and garbage cans are pink, and there are purple Davie Village banners on the lampposts. They're symbols of a time when this was a gay mecca, when the West End was an affordable middle-class neighborhood, and queers flocked here from all over Canada to find each other. One of the high-rises was affectionately known as Vaseline Towers. I moved here in 1990 when I was 17. In 1993, I started a radio show called Queer FM on CITR. I had no idea at the time, but I was about to document one of the most phenomenal decades in the struggle for queer equality, 1995 to 2005. It was the decade we went from no constitutional human rights to full legal marriage. On January 1st, 1995, there were no rainbow crosswalks and no purple banners on Davie Street. The gayest looking thing in the West End was an outrageous cafe called Doll and Penny's. It had a full-size red sports car and life-size department store mannequins on top of its marquee. The sign in the window said, "Sorry, we're open." Community was just a dirty white building called the Gay and Lesbian Center. The floor was a patchwork of filthy, mismatched carpets. The real center of the community was Little Sister's bookstore. It was still in its old location on Thurlow Street, on the top floor of an old converted house. The stairwell had a landing halfway up that was like the gay Craigslist of the 1990s. It was wallpapered with event posters and handwritten notices offering rooms to rent or furniture for sale. When I first started going there, I keep my eyes open for suspicious packages while I was walking up those stairs. The store had been bombed 3 times. Most people didn't know it then, but at the start of 1995, we were heading towards a court decision that was about to change our lives.
My name is Barbara Finlay. I am a fat, white, old, cisgender lesbian lawyer who grew up working class and was raised Christian on the prairies. I live with disabilities. I've done a lot of work for lesbians, gay men, bisexual, and transgender people. And I taught in the Faculty of Law at UBC. You can work that in somewhere. By the time 1995 rolled around, British Columbia had added sexual orientation as a protected ground under the Human Rights Code. Canada had not yet done that. However, the big news in the previous decade was that the Canadian Charter of Rights and Freedoms had come into effect with its equality section in 1985. That law provides that everyone has the right to be free from discrimination, and in particular, discrimination based on race, sex, ancestry, place of origin, religious belief, or physical or mental disability. You'll notice that missing from that list was sexual orientation. The court decided early on that those words, quote, and in particular, unquote, meant that the list of protected grounds in the Charter was not a closed list. It was an open list, and if you could demonstrate that you were a member of a group historically marginalized, that you would be entitled to Charter protection. So, that was the situation in 1995 when we all held our collective breaths to see what the Supreme Court of Canada was going to do in the case of Egan and Nesbitt versus Canada. Egan and Nesbitt were two senior citizens. One of them retired. When the second one retired, he applied for a spousal benefit available under a federal program to the spouses of people whose income was below a particular level. They were refused because in the eyes of the law, they weren't spouses. The argument was this. As gay men, Egan and Nesbitt were part of a group of people in Canadian society who had been historically marginalized and discriminated against, and were therefore entitled to the protection of the Canadian Charter of Rights and Freedoms. There were two reasons we held our breath. Most commentators expected that sexual orientation would be added to the list of prohibited grounds. But lots of commentators were not sure whether that would be extended to our partners. If I'm protected on the ground basis of sexual orientation, then you can't refuse to hire me in the military because I'm a lesbian, for example. But separately, when you hire me in the military, do you have to give spousal benefits to my partner? It's actually hard to capture for somebody who lives in a world in which equality for queers is a taken-for-granted feature of our existence, how much doubt there was that we would ever actually succeed in asserting that we deserved to be treated as human beings. I was terrified.
A lot of my friends who are not...
This is me on Queer FM, 2 days after the decision came down in May of 1995. I'm talking to Lawrence Aronovich of the gay lobby group AGAL.
Well, it is a confusing judgment. It was basically a 4-1-4 decision amongst the nine justices. All nine judges agreed that sexual orientation must be read into the Charter of Rights as a ground of discrimination analogous to the existing grounds, for example, race, sex, religion, and so forth. But above and beyond that, five of the nine judges, which is a slim majority, but nevertheless a majority, agreed that the refusal to recognize same-sex relationships in this case constitutes discrimination. Mm-hmm. So a majority ruled that relationships, never mind sexual orientation for the individual, but same-sex relationships are covered by Section 15.
Okay. Mm.
What happened is that one of the five judges also said that even though it's discriminatory, Parliament has the right to make that kind of discrimination, and that's what's called a Section 1 exclusion.
So exactly how does a judge justify discrimination, you ask? Justice John Sapinka wrote that the court needed to give the government time to accommodate what he called, quote, new social relationships. I will pause here to point out that Egan and Nesbitt had been in a relationship for 47 years. But basically, the court was saying this. Yes, gay people are equal to straight people. And yes, gay relationships are equal to straight relationships. But we're not going to force the government to give you that equality just yet. Make no mistake about it, though, this was a massive victory. because after Egan, there was no more question of if we had rights. There was only a question of when.
So my name is MTS Poppet. I'm a coordinator of Salaam Vancouver Queer Muslim Community. And yeah, I used to write for Angles magazine and also wrote for the UBC from time to time. 1995, there was an interesting time where indigenous folks and people of color were just coming out into the queer community. It was, you know, it was a time for isolation too, right? You know, you go into a bar and you see another brown person and they will be scared to come and talk to you even because they had self-shame because a lot of people that came out had to become white just to fit in. Because if we didn't and we wore traditional clothes and things like that, then we would face racism where people say, what's that all about? So I wrote this opinion piece in Angles magazine called Racism and Queerdom, which created such a ruckus in the community because people weren't ready to hear that. And my motivation for writing that piece was really a challenge to the queer community as our allies that we need to look at intersectionalities of our oppression and that people in the queer community I count on as being allies to fight racism, but it wasn't taken well. But I think it was ahead of its time.
A month after the Supreme Court gave us our first major victory, Parliament gave us another first. It passed the first ever piece of legislation containing the words sexual orientation. It was called Bill C-41. It allowed judges to hand down tougher sentences for crimes if it was clear that the crimes were motivated by hatred of a marginalized group. Gays, lesbians, and bisexuals were on the list of marginalized groups. The introduction of this bill led to yet another first. This one, somewhat more notorious. The first homophobic tirade in the House of Commons. Roseanne Skoke was the Liberal MP for Central Nova. This is what she said.
I wish to go on record today as taking exception to the specific inclusion of the wording of sexual orientation in our criminal code amendment. The inclusion of this wording, in effect, gives special rights, special consideration to homosexuals. The reference to sexual orientation in the code and its proposed inclusion in the human rights legislation gives recognition to a faction in our society which is undermining and destroying our Canadian values and Christian morality. Canadians do not have to accept homosexuality as being natural and moral. Homosexuality is not natural, it is immoral, and it is undermining the inherent rights and values of our Canadian families, and it must not and should not be condoned.
Skoke was the first Member of Parliament to declare that she didn't think gay people deserved equality. It was so shocking at the time, it made news across the country. Before long, outbursts like hers were so common, they weren't news at all. A year after the government passed Bill C-41, it added the word sexual orientation to the Canadian Human Rights Act. That made it illegal for federally regulated industries like banks and airlines to discriminate against lesbians, gays, and bisexuals, either in the workplace or in the provision of services. A member of parliament named Dave Chatters argued against the bill by saying that companies should be allowed to fire gay people if customers didn't approve of them. Another MP, Bob Ringma, argued that employers should be allowed to send gay or black employees to the back of the shop if bigoted customers complained about them. Our opponents described equal rights as special rights, and homosexuality as either a lifestyle choice or an involuntary affliction similar to kleptomania. They also said that protecting people from discrimination based on sexual orientation would end up giving protection to pedophiles.
My name is Mary Wu Sims, and I'm the former Chief Human Rights Commissioner for British Columbia. Now that we have equal marriage, you look back on that debate, 20 years ago, and you just think, what was that all about? Because it was pretty hateful. There's still the discussion about whether we are so-called deviants. And so I just look back on those years and think, wow, we were still in the dark ages compared to where we are now.
In 1996, things started changing rapidly at the provincial level. That year, the NDP government changed our adoption laws so that same-sex couples could jointly apply to adopt children. In 97, it changed family maintenance and custody laws so that same-sex couples who were breaking up had the same rights as heterosexual couples to custody, child support, and spousal maintenance. But with that recognition of same-sex families came a whole new battle. How should the school system teach about our families? And what about the rights of queer kids? This next piece of tape you'll hear comes from a forum on queer education in the year 2000.
My name is James Chamberlain, and I teach at George Vanier Elementary in Surrey. In April of 97, I put forward some books for district approval in my district about same-gender families. The way our school district works is it's very tightly controlled in terms of what you can and can't read in the classroom under what's called personal planning, or sort of the sex ed or family life portion of the curriculum at the elementary level. And so I had to put these books forward for district approval, but the school trustees decided that these were not suitable for kindergarten or any other grade level, and so they banned them.
My name is Murray Corrin. I was a primary teacher with the Coquitlam School Board. I've been affiliated with UBC for a good number of years and making presentations around issues to do with queer education and queers in the education, public education system. I and James Chamberlain were involved in an informal association called the Gay and Lesbian Educators of British Columbia, the acronym being GALBC. And we used our connections with our local teachers' associations to bring forward a resolution to the British Columbia Teachers Federation to establish a program that would bring about the elimination of homophobia and heterosexism in the BC public school system. So all of this was happening very simultaneously, right around the time of the British Columbia Teachers Federation's AGM, which was a very emotionally charged AGM. There were picketers outside, there were queer kids on one side of the street, and there were huge numbers of parents who were against, holding placards talking about how sinful homosexuality is and how we were all going to go to hell, and the BCTF was promoting the gay agenda and so on. So it was a really tense weekend. While all of this stuff was going on, James had submitted the request for the books to be approved and the school board denying their request. When the board finally came down with the decision not to allow the books to be used, we were approached by our lawyer by the name of Joe Arvey. And Joe said, you know, are you going to allow the Surrey School Board to get away with this? The case then began in the Supreme Court of British Columbia and was heard by Justice Mary Saunders, and she came down on our side, and therefore the Surrey School Board was required to pay our costs.
It's hard to overstate just how big a controversy this teaching tolerance of gay families became. It got the attention of a group called the Citizens Research Institute, whose leader was Carrie Simpson. The CRI was what you might call a parents' rights group. When schools started teaching children that gay people existed, the CRI said the state was undermining parents' rights to teach their children about sexual morality. I will pause here to play you a clip of what one of those banned books actually says. This is a local broadcaster named Hal Wake reading from One Dad, Two Dads, Brown Dad, Blue Dads at a fundraiser for the court case against the book ban.
Blue Dads, I didn't know who has dads that are blue. I do. My name is Lou. I have two dads who are both blue.
Carrie Simpson toured the province speaking at large rallies. She drafted a document called the Declaration of Family Rights and told parents to place it in their children's file at school. It demanded that teachers not expose their children to anything that might imply that, quote, the lifestyle of gays and lesbians was, quote, normal, acceptable, or must be tolerated. The Minister of Education at this time was Paul Ramsey. He spoke out against Carrie Simpson. He also threatened to fire the Surrey School Board for violating the School Act by promoting intolerance. So Simpson's supporters tried to fire him. Under BC's recall legislation, they had 2 months to collect around 8,900 signatures on petitions to oust Ramsey from the legislature. They fell short by less than 600.
Hi, I'm Tim Stevenson, currently a Vancouver City Councillor, and prior to that was an MLA and a cabinet minister in the provincial government. I came to UBC later in my life, in my early 30s, and within a fairly short time, I became the president of the UBC. In 1996, when I became an MLA, we were struggling just even to change the definition of spouse, and this wasn't even to have marriage. I mean, marriage wasn't even on the radar. Ujo Dosage, myself, and now, ironically, Rachel Notley, who's now the Premier of Alberta, we were the three that took on changing the definition of spouse in British Columbia in every piece of legislature in the province, and we were successful. Rachel Notley was a young lawyer, brilliant, and she was a ministerial assistant to Ujo Dosage. The Liberal opposition at the time, they were saying, oh, this is just a smokescreen. All you want to do is open this up to marriage. And we kept saying, no, we want to make sure that the definition of spouse has just changed within all of the legislature. That's a different fight. That may come down the line. And so they were trying to stop it at that point because they saw that as opening the door. And I guess in many ways they were right. I don't think people realize even today as to the monumental decision that was, because anywhere in any piece of legislation that it referred to spouse, that legislation was changed to include gay and lesbian.
By the end of the 90s, the Supreme Court of Canada was no longer giving governments the flexibility to recognize gay rights on their own timeline. In 1998, it ordered the Alberta government to protect lesbian, gay, and bisexual people from discrimination in employment and services. Then, in 1999, it ruled that Ontario had to treat same-sex couples as spouses. The case was called M versus H. It involved a woman who was left penniless after her lesbian partner broke up with her. She tried to sue her ex for spousal support, but Ontario's Family Law Act defined a spouse as an opposite-sex partner. The M versus H decision meant that governments across Canada had to do what BC was already doing, change every law that defined a spouse as an opposite-sex partner to include same-sex partners. This is MTS Poppet.
It was around that time somebody told me there was a queer Muslim conference happening in New York called Al-Fatiha, which was a genesis of the global queer Muslim movement. And to me, that was really important. So I came to Vancouver and we started a chapter of Al-Fatiha in Vancouver. But you know, because Fatiha is not just the opening part of the Quran, it's also a prayer you say when people die at the cemetery. Some people thought that the name Al-Fatiha was kind of morbid. So we changed our name to Salamat, which is the root of Salam. The people and the faith communities were very welcoming. So, you know, we started doing dialogue with queer Jews and then connecting with also with indigenous communities and their spirituality. So I think that was really important because, you know, when people started coming out in the 90s, people couldn't put spirituality and faith and being queer together. It was a struggle for them. And by creating these faith communities, we were giving people an opportunity to say that, yes, we can be queer and Muslim, or queer and Christian, or queer and Jew. And people were reclaiming that, because a lot of people had to leave their faith communities in order to come out as trans, as lesbian, gay, and so on.
Here's Mary Wu Sims.
A couple of other comments that I want to make about just that period of time. And that is that I think that as a community, we really grew from thinking of ourselves as predominantly white middle class movement to a seriously rainbow coalition or community. That's not to say that we don't have pockets of racism still that exist in our community, or that we don't understand necessarily the plight of people who are poor in our community. You know, there's still a work to be done, but I do think that in those years where we were struggling as a community, we needed help, and there was help that came from all segments of society.
Same-sex couples were now equal to heterosexual couples in every way except marriage. But homophobia in the school system was still a major issue. In March of 2000, a young student in Surrey named Hamed Nasto filled his backpack with rocks and jumped off the Patullo Bridge. He left a suicide note that said he could no longer take the harassment he was getting at school. He said kids called him gay and faggot, even though he was neither of those things. His story helped raise people's awareness about the problem of homophobic bullying. And then there was a setback in the Surrey School Board case. Here's Murray Corrin.
The Surrey School Board decided to appeal the decision, and in that particular instance, the court came down with what we considered a very muddy decision. They said, you know, both sides were right and both sides were wrong, and we were required then to return the costs which we had won at the lower level. My husband and I were funding this case, and our house was standing as collateral in the event that we would have to pay for this case. And at that time, we had a legal bill of over $300,000. We tried to convince primarily the kindergarten teacher to allow the case to go forward, and he was very reluctant to do so. And so, therefore, we had to indemnify him and all of the other petitioners on the case, so that should we have lost at the Supreme Court of Canada, my husband and I would have been entirely responsible for all costs related to the case. You know, it was difficult to imagine that we might lose our house because of this. There was no guarantee that we were going to win.
At the end of 2000, queers scored a partial victory in a massive battle that dated back to 1990. It was a fight between Little Sisters Bookstore and the Canada Border Services Agency, which used to be called Canada Customs.
My name is Ken Bozum. I have been working at Little Sisters for almost 11 years. So Little Sisters actually opened in 1983, and then they started becoming aware that they were really being targeted. It actually started with a copy of The Advocate, which is not really porny at all. It's like a news magazine, really. It was seized by Canada Customs, who is now Border Services Agency. Somebody at Customs had opened the package or the box that contained the magazines, and they didn't like the way it looked. It made them feel funny inside, whatever. And consequently, the magazines weren't delivered. And so this would happen over and over and over again. Books didn't come. And then one year, their entire shipment of stuff, pretty much, for Christmas, didn't arrive. Finally, Celia Duffy, who used to be the owner of a really prominent book chain in Vancouver just before the first round of the case, she said, well, what are the titles that you're having trouble with? And so she turned around and ordered in all of those titles, and all of them came through with no problem at all. And so it became clear that it was just that the store was being targeted because it was gay or lesbian. Jim, for those who knew him, was a very feisty little banty rooster from the prairies. He was not going to take that sitting down. So the store filed suit against Canada Customs.
In order to understand this story, it helps to understand a little bit about how Border Services works. Agents are allowed to intercept packages coming across the border and seize items that are banned in Canada. Most of those banned items are pretty easy to spot. Guns, drugs, certain exotic animals, for example. But Canada also has laws against obscene reading material, and that means that border agents are also de facto censors. They're allowed to hold shipments of books and magazines and videos at the border while they figure out if anything in them is obscene. That power is known as prior restraint. Here's Ken Bosom.
The issue of who decides what you can or can't read was really the crux of the case. The man who used to be the book buyer at the store, Mark McDonald, he's commented that there are people on the front line whose job it is to make sure that there isn't, you know, a potato beetle on your farm vehicle that's coming into the country. And those same people that are supposed to be making those choices are somehow supposed to choose whether or not you're allowed to read about this, that, or the other thing, you know. Any citizen could order a book and have their package detained at the border, and it became a case of guilty until proven innocent if you were the person trying to bring that in. So then the onus was on you financially and legally to prove to the country, essentially, that it was a safe and okay book or magazine to bring in.
Little Sisters asked the court to remove Border Service's power of prior restraint altogether. It said the agency was so homophobic and so useless at judging the artistic merit of literature that it was violating gay people's constitutional right to equality. It said the system was too broken to fix. The Supreme Court of Canada handed down its decision on December 15, 2000. This is John Dixon from the BC Civil Liberties Association speaking at a press conference at the bookstore.
We've won. We didn't win everything we wanted. The court didn't accept our plea to strike down the Customs Act in its entirety, insofar as it gives them the power to seize books. But it said this: no more reverse onus. No more will it be the case in Canada that an importer of books or magazines or videos must take up the onus or burden of proving that those materials are not obscene. If the government wants to seize it at the border, the government is going to have to prove that it is obscene in a court of law. And a clock will run. At the end of 30 days, the government must be willing to go into a court of law and prove that the matter is obscene. This changes, in our view, utterly the nature of the relationship of Little Sisters to customs, and it changes utterly the relationship of Canadians to expression materials in general. And this win for all Canadians is due in great measure to the wonderful shamelessness of the clients of the Civil Liberties Association, who have refused to be ashamed of who they are, have refused to be ashamed of how they live and act and imagine and communicate with one another about their sexuality. And I congratulate them.
Thank you.
This is Little Sisters manager, Janine Fuller.
As a store, as a group of people who have undergone seizures after seizures and decades of struggle against Canada Customs, we feel enormously vindicated that the Supreme Court has reconsidered how Canada Customs has to operate in this country.
Here's Ken Bosom.
The significance of the decision in the end is sort of multiple. It's really one of the first few cases where the gay community really stood up to the government, and I think it's one of the first big cases where everybody was really on board with it, because it involved ideas and it was like people telling us we couldn't think things, we couldn't write things. And so I think it really raised the awareness of most Canadians that this was even a thing. Like, most people didn't even realize that some random person in a suit was deciding what you could or couldn't read. I think the sort of legacy of it, in a sense, is the community that we're in. In a lot of ways, the actions that people went through, the acts of defiance, the acts of fundraising that people had to sort of come together on to raise money for this crazy, insanely expensive court case, like the fundraiser after fundraiser after fundraiser, it's all community building stuff. And when you're painting placards with people, when you're planning events with people, you know, you're getting to know the other people in your community and you're building a strong community. And I think that the strong community we have in Vancouver as a gay place and a safe place for queer people to come to, I think is largely because of that case in many ways.
It's This is MTS Poppet.
Little Sisters was big because they represented diversity as well. You know, they had titles of people like Shamsu Sabadurai and Shani Mutu and people from our community who are writers. And we could go there and read these. And we had people like Sham and Shani who had readings at Little Sisters. And it was part of our connection to the community. And when we, you know, we won those battles, it was a victory for all of us.
Oh, but wait, what are we doing?
Chapel and we're gonna get married. Going to the chapel and we're gonna get married.
In 2001, the battle for full legal marriage rights for same-sex couples finally came to the fore. 8 BC couples had launched a court case seeking full marriage equality. There were similar cases going forward in Ontario and Quebec. Lawyers argued the case in the BC Supreme Court in August of 2001. What you're about to hear is a rather tongue-in-cheek recap of that hearing. One of the couples threw a party at their house after it wrapped up. I interviewed people while they were, shall we say, unwinding. The first voice you'll hear belongs to Dave Short, one half of one of the couples suing for marriage. The other guy with a New Zealand accent is John Fisher. He was the executive director of EGAL.
First of all, like, what's your impression of how the case went?
I had my doubts. At the beginning, I was pretty confident that the judge took the position that marriage was up for debate, and then by the end I felt like he was having serious doubts about his capacity to make a decision about this case in our favor.
I concur.
Really?
Yeah, really. No, okay, you want me to elaborate, don't you? I can tell. I agree. I mean, I think that this is, in fact, an easy case. All we're doing is coming to the court and asking the judge to apply the law. We've won this case already on the issue of the application of the constitutional principle to same-sex relationships. There are previous cases from the Supreme Court that are directly on point that say definitions of spouse which exclude us cannot be justified. The arguments that have been raised by the government, by the interveners, are the same old arguments we've heard for years. There was nothing new here. They used to come to court and say spouse is inherently heterosexual, it involves procreation, heterosexual units need to be maintained in society or else chaos will follow. They said all the same things in this hearing, except they just substituted the word marriage for the word spouse. And yet, while we've won, I think, on the legal principles previously, there is something about the institution of marriage which still strikes at the hearts and minds of some heterosexuals as something which is just a big social institution that can't be changed. Obviously, the scale of the issue is not relevant for constitutional or legal purposes. The judge still has a responsibility to apply the charter, apply the law, and find in our favor. Nonetheless, I think that the interveners against us were successful in essentially creating concerns within the judge about what he's being asked to do, and that creates concerns with us that he may be influenced by that and find against us. But, of course, all that remains to be seen.
How did you feel about the performance of all of the different lawyers who were acting in favor of the petitioners?
Well, all our team was great. The others, I wasn't persuaded at all. I thought the AG of Canada was silly, and the interveners against us were just offensive. That's my summary. Do you want me to elaborate on that at all?
If you could, that would be great.
Okay. Well, the Attorney General of Canada was not terribly persuasive. For me, one of the memorable moments of the hearing was when she described heterosexual procreation as the historical purpose of marriage rather than the historical purpose. And, of course, we all rolled with the laughter, and the judge acknowledged that many people would probably agree with her that this was a historical purpose.
And what did you guys think of the judge in the case?
Well, I think if he finds in our favor, he's great. If he finds against us, then clearly there are fundamental points that he's not grasped.
So it's, we'll see whether what we think about him until the ruling.
That's right.
If he doesn't find in our favor, what happens from here? Can we appeal?
Mass suicide.
Thank you, Dave. Or that is one option, as Dave has identified. The other alternative is we could appeal, and I think probably that is what we'll be recommending to our clients.
The decision came down from the courts less than 3 months later. This is another one of the litigants in the case. Her name is Tanya Chambers.
I was checking my email at a little, like, 24-hour 7-Eleven type store, and I found, oh, bad news, we lost. So it wasn't exactly a great day. I was frustrated and angry and sad. And I think the thing that hit me the most is I took it a lot more personal than I thought I would. That it wasn't just an attack on gay couples, that it was like, you're not good enough. Your relationship, even though we're discriminating against you, it doesn't matter. You're not good enough to deserve to be married.
If losing the marriage case was a blow to the community, what happened next was much, much worse. In November of 2001, word went out that a man had been murdered in Stanley Park. 41-year-old Aaron Webster had been swarmed by a group of young men who beat him with baseball bats and pool cues. They found him in a gay cruising area. Anti-gay assaults had been going on in the West End for years. A gay park board commissioner named Duncan Wilson had been beaten in 1996. The murder of Aaron Webster became like a focal point for the community's rage. The day after it happened, Jim Diva, the co-owner of Little Sisters, organized a march and rally. This is him speaking.
Society has somehow begun to accept us. The polls are going up in our favor. But yet this violence continues. It's like we've lived in a state of terrorism since we've come out. And I think it's time that we say that we will not put up with this terrorism anymore. We will not be looking behind our shoulders to see if there's a gang of young men out there to kill us.
The police charged four men with Webster's murder. Three were convicted. But remember that sentencing legislation that the government passed back in 1995? The one that allowed judges to hand down stiffer sentences for hate crimes against minorities? Well, the Crown never asked for it, and that led to more outrage. In 2002, we finally made some positive strides for queer youth and queer families in the school system. In the United States, queer teens had begun suing school districts that failed to protect them from homophobic bullying. A Wisconsin man named Jamie Nabosny won close to $1 million in damages. In North Vancouver, a young student named Asmi Jubran did a similar thing. He filed a human rights complaint against his school board. The Human Rights Commission awarded him $4,000. The second victory that came in 2002 was in the Surrey School Board case. Here's Murray Corrin.
We had received, I think on Sunday night in December of 2002, notification that the board was coming down with its decision the next morning. I sat there at 7 o'clock in the morning, clicking refresh, and nothing was happening, and nothing was happening, and I'm getting really tense and worried, and suddenly my phone rings. And it's a journalist from the CBC, and she says, well, what do you think? And I said, think about what? She said, about the decision. And I said, you know, with great trepidation, I said, what was the decision? She said, you won. And I just dropped the phone, and I ran down the hall, and I said to Peter, we've won it. And we just both fell into each other's arms and cried with such relief and joy. Looking back on it today, I think it was a seminal move on the part of the courts to validate our realities as queer people, and particularly children in the public education system. One of the statements that the Chief Justice of the Court, Beverly McLaughlin, made in her finding, she said, tolerance is always age appropriate.
Go into the chapel and we're
gonna get married. Going to the chapel and we're gonna get married. Gee, I really love you and we're...
In 2003, the same-sex marriage case went to appeal. By this point, the momentum had shifted in our favor. Courts in Ontario and Quebec had already made same-sex marriage legal, but the rulings wouldn't take effect until July 12, 2004. That was because the court wanted to give governments time to do things like change paperwork and possibly, you know, legalize same-sex divorce, just in case. The litigants in BC were optimistic that our court would rule the same way. This is one of their lawyers, Joe Arvey, speaking on the day of the decision.
Thank you for coming to the press conference. We're pleased to report that the British Columbia Court of Appeal, the first Court of Appeal in Canada, has ruled that the federal common law bar, that the federal common law that restricts same-sex couples from marrying is unconstitutional. It was a unanimous decision. It was a definitive decision. It's a decision we're very, very pleased with. So as a practical matter, what this decision means is that gay and lesbians can now marry in Canada, although their right to marry won't be allowed until July 2004.
That press conference took place on May 1st, 2003. On June 10th, the Ontario Court of Appeal ruled that same-sex couples in that province could start marrying immediately. So the BC couples went back to the court and asked for the right to do the same. On July 8th, they were back at the courthouse waiting for that decision. Here's Tim Stevenson.
I'm the first openly gay person who was ordained in any church in Canada, in the United Church of Canada. When I had my own church, and I had one for 4 years in Burnaby before I went into politics, a couple came to me, and this would be, you know, way back in like 1994, 1995, and then they said they wanted to have a marriage ceremony or a blessing. And would I do that? And I said, sure. And then many years later, all of a sudden I got a call from Tom and Anthony saying that they were in this court procedure and there was a decision that was going to be made. And they wanted me to come if the decision was affirmative from the courts and marry them on the steps of the courthouse immediately after the decision. So I said, sure, I'll do that. Now, by this time, I'm a city councilor in Vancouver. And so we went to the courthouse to wait, and I don't know what time, but the judge made his ruling and said that marriages would be allowed in British Columbia. Huge cheers and so on. And we went outside onto the steps of the courthouse. And there must have been, 100 reporters and cameras. I mean, there it is, totally surrounded. Rather odd kind of way to do a marriage. Didn't feel very religious, you know.
So I'd ask now that you turn and face one another. And Tom, if you would repeat after me. In the presence of God and before these witnesses.
In the presence of God and before these witnesses.
I, Tom.
Take you, Anthony.
To be my life partner, my spouse.
To be my life partner, my spouse.
To have and to hold from this day forward.
To have and to hold from this day forward.
For better, for worse.
For better, for worse.
For richer, for poorer.
For richer, for poorer.
In sickness and in health.
In sickness and in health.
In joy and in sorrow.
In joy and in sorrow.
To love and to cherish.
To love and to cherish.
As long as we both shall live.
Yes, we both. As long as we both shall live.
And now, the regular book says that the man and woman may kiss. The two men may kiss.
Yeah.
Anyway, I did that marriage, and they were married, and that was the first marriage in British Columbia.
the next year or so, couples launch court cases in other Canadian provinces and territories, trying to open the door to same-sex marriage in those regions. In all, we racked up 11 court victories in 9 provinces and territories. Meanwhile, the federal government announced it would give up the fight. It would not appeal to the Supreme Court of Canada. Instead, it would draft legislation to legalize same-sex marriage nationwide and ask the Supreme Court of Canada for an opinion on it. It was around this time that a group called Canadians for Equal Marriage really rose to prominence. Here's Mary Wu Sims.
Canadians for Equal Marriage was really a broad public interest group that formed out of those fights across the country for relationship recognition and the right to marry, and included at the very beginning EGAL Canada, but then grew to include a whole range of people, including like the PFLAG, the Canadian Labor Congress, Chinese Canadian National Congress, the Canadian Federation of Students. I think having community groups that are not necessarily linked with the GLBT community come out in favor of our right to marry was very, very significant. People from the Sikh community, people from Jewish community, people from various faiths as well as racialized communities come out and speak in favor of equal marriage and why it was important was, I think, one of the huge achievements of the movement.
In early 2004, we scored one more victory that had nothing to do with marriage. It came courtesy of Sven Robinson, Canada's first openly gay member of parliament. Sven put forward a private member's bill that would add sexual orientation to the hate speech provisions of Canada's criminal code. In other words, it made it illegal to promote hatred against gays, lesbians, and bisexuals. Sven wasn't a member of the governing party, so he had to rally support from other parties in order to pass it. It was a major accomplishment on his part. Here's Sven on Queer FM after it passed.
Words can be very powerful, and words can lead to actions that promote hatred and ultimately violence. So my hope is that by the passage of this bill, that there will be fewer people that are bashed.
The month after Sven's bill became law, Parliament dissolved for an election. And so began more than a year of collective nail-biting for queer activists. The Liberals were tanking in the polls because of the sponsorship scandal. The Conservatives were ahead, and they opposed same-sex marriage. If they won, that would be the end of the marriage bill. But the Liberals fought back, saying the Conservatives had a secret agenda to get themselves elected and then roll back gay rights and abortion rights and gut public health care. Conservative candidates had said and done plenty of things in recent history to make this claim believable. Then, 3 days before the election, a filmmaker named Alexis McIntosh released footage from a documentary she was making about same-sex marriage. It showed a Conservative MP from Abbotsford named Randy White saying his party would use the constitutional notwithstanding clause to override gay marriage. The notwithstanding clause allows governments to pass laws that violate people's charter rights, but it's considered a legislative tool of last resort, only to be used in the rarest of circumstances. Many political pundits believe White's comments help contribute to his party's defeat. It's worth pausing here for a moment to comment on the changing political times. In 1996, being a pro-gay politician was such a liability that it nearly cost the BC education minister his job. In 2004, being an anti-gay politician was such a liability, it might have lost the entire Conservative Party an election. On June 28th, the Liberals returned to office with a minority government. At the end of that year, the Supreme Court gave the green light to its same-sex marriage bill. Now the government just had to survive long enough to pass it. And it almost didn't. On May 19th, it squeaked through a budget vote by a single vote. And that brings us to June 28th, 2005. the day the marriage bill saw its final vote in the House of Commons. Queers in Vancouver were at the Pump Jack Pub watching it on CPAC on the big screen TV.
The question is the following, where Mr. Cotton, seconded by Mr. Peterson, moved that Bill C-38, an act respecting certain aspects of legal capacity for marriage for a civil purpose, be now read a third time and do pass. In favor of the motion, will please rise.
Monsieur Martel Salamard.
The crowd cheered when our supporters stood up to cast their votes. They booed when our opponents voted against us. And then it happened.
Nays pour 158, 158. Nays contre 133, 133.
I pinch myself. I go from a time when I came to UBC when we had no rights at all. So in my lifetime, I've gone from it being a criminal act in Canada to today is huge. We've really achieved so much in such a small period of time.
I look back on it with a great deal of pride because that decade solidified so many things as far as our rights are concerned, but also in how our community came together to support one another. Demonstration after demonstration, rally after rally around education, around marriage and so on, I think brought us together in ways that really solidified who we are as people. And that makes me, you know, very, very proud.
I keep not wanting to be complacent about it and keep reminding ourselves and myself of the struggles that continue by others in our community, those who are Aboriginal, those who are poor, those who have disabilities. They also need our assistance, so I don't want us to be forgetful of them.
To 2005 was written and produced by me, Heather Kitching. Madeline Taylor engineered the interviews. Glenn Nutio sourced that Roseanne Scope tape from the Library and Archives of Canada. Queer Decade uses music composed by Kevin MacLeod of Incompetech.com and licensed under Creative Commons by Attribution 3.0. Details are at http://creativecommons.org/licenses/by/3.0. The compositions are called Flipotron, Shades of Spring, Walking Along, Spellbound, Acid Jazz, Chipperdoodle Volume 2, EDM Detection Mode, Ether Disco, Pyro Flow, Danger Storm, Lightness Dawn, Babylon, Son of a Rocket, String Disco, Your Call, and Basement Floor. Queer Decade is a production of CITR Radio and the UBC Centennial Initiatives Fund.
You've just been listening to CITR's UBC 100 Doc series. We would like to thank UBC Centennial Initiatives Fund, Peter Doolin, Emily Morgan, Shyla Seller, and Katie Harris for researching, digitizing, and cataloging our archive tape. Thanks to Robert and Bronwyn at the UBC Library Digitization Center for partnering with us to digitize, launch, and host the audio collection. And Erwin at the UBC University Archives, thank you to Nardwar the Human Serbiette and to Madeline Taylor for organizing this project and supporting our documentary producers.
And visit our website, citr.ca/docs, for podcasts, interviews with the producers, and more information.